Angela Stott is going to be dealing with the scientific sides, the creation versus evolution, issues of origins. Now, many of you may know of Angela's father, Philip Stott, our favorite creation scientist. He's the top creation science authority in our country, the engineer who designed and built the Quasimodo Auditorium, which can seat 10,000 people. And he's ministered all over the world, including in Russia, ministering from one side to the other, that atheistic country, teaching creation. Well, Angela Stott, I remember first hearing of her back in 1990 when she was the top student in the country for the matric results, and that created quite something to have this little mission station school in the middle of nowhere, as far as people knew, producing the top student in the country. And frequently, Quasimodo School has produced students in the top 10 in matric, so it's an extraordinary thing. Angela Stott has got a doctorate in science. She specialized in zoology, biology, physics, studied through Potchefstroom University and UNISA. And at the moment, she's involved in a very exciting textbook development, curriculum development program going around the country dealing with this in science. So we praise God. Angela is going to be dealing with us for the series on origins. So over to you, Angela.
Right, now, I'm here to speak about origins. When you hear about origins, you normally think of evolution, and it's good to start with oneself. So let me begin with my own evolution. Millions of years ago, that was me. Actually, that was when I was in matric. I actually wanted a photo of a few years earlier when the glasses were even bigger. Because at that stage, when I was in grade 8, 7, 6, Stanger High School, I was in my religious instruction class, and the teacher said, "Who here believes that God created the world and there was no evolution?" So I put up my hand, and I was imagining the whole heaven, applauding. I was so brave. And then one of the kids piped up and said, "But how does it actually work, you know, because there's so much scientific evidence that evolution happened. So, you know, how do you explain that away?" And I turned my gaze and I absolutely had no idea what to say. None at all. Of course, I had to save face, so I said, "Oh, I'm not going to tell you, because even if I would tell you, you wouldn't believe me." And that is all that I could say. Now, after millions of years, why is this thing? As the glass, okay, over millions of years, the glasses devolved in size and then became extinct. And many eons later, then you got that fossil up there. Fortunately, during that long period of evolution, my understanding of origins did improve somewhat. If you know anything about evolution, they say there are these transitional forms, which are in between, you know, like you get between an ape and a man is an ape man. So this is one of my transitional forms. When I was in a particularly crazy mood. I think Calvin calls it mad scientist or something. And the glasses were a little bit smaller then. But not so long ago, my dad and I decided we need to make a book about origins. That's my dad. My dad is actually the expert, so if I don't know anything, I'm safe. And so we made this book. It's not a coloring in book. And we are going to work through it a bit in the few days that we're together here, because I want this more to be like a workshop. And so you please need to have these books every time that we do something, you know, when I'm presenting, and you need to have a pen or a pencil to be able to write in. And at times I'll ask you to discuss it. This book was created for the life sciences curriculum for South Africa. It doesn't only have to be used then, but there isn't anything available from a creation perspective for that. So that's what we particularly created for. And so you meant to work through it about 4 hours in class every week for about 4 weeks. So we're definitely not going to be able to work through all of it, but I'm just picking out a few things here and there. And if you are more serious about this topic, then you can do a greater in-depth study yourself. Let's just get a bit of an idea of what the structure of the book is. So if you can turn to the contents page, you can see that it's broken up into five sections. First of all, A, we deal with the options, and that's what we're going to look at today, as well as some other stuff I'll get to just now. Then we deal with philosophy about how we know things. That's Monday's topic. And then we look at data which can serve as evidence, and that will be the next 2 days. Evaluation, that's actually just a section, we'll turn to it just now, which is blank for you to fill in notes. So if you want to use that feature, you can use it. And then we get a lot of appendices at the end, and that's a lot of information. So the first part is a lot of activities, and then we get to information. So if we turn to page 55, you can see that that's the start of what we call evaluation, which is really just gaps for you to fill in your own notes. And I'll explain a bit more what those headings mean as you go through. And then as you page on, you can see a lot of information, appendix 1 onwards. And so, yeah, I obviously cannot, in the short time available, really equip you to be able to defend this very thoroughly, defend intelligent design. So you will need to do some reading on your own. So that's what those appendices are for. Alright, so what this book is all about is asking the question, how did Turtle get his shell?
And we've got some characters. If you go to page 5, you'll see that's the first introduction to these characters, Sandra and Sofiso. And they speak throughout just to make it a bit more friendly. You can be guided, you know, the logic of the progression of thoughts by looking at what they're saying in the speech bubble. And here Sandra has the same dilemma that I had, that I just described to you, that she was brought up being taught that God created the world in 6 days. But now she's at an age when she needs to know for herself, is that so? And if so, what is the evidence? And how do you explain it to someone else? And that's the journey that we're going to try to do. On Thursday, the last time that I have her talk, if it works out right, I mean, it's the first time that I've done this, so I hope the timing will work and everything. But the plan is that we'll actually have a debate. But not, I thought that to get more people actually active, rather than that we have people sitting out there and we all watch, everyone is going to debate and have little groups. Now I'm explaining just now. Alright, so we want to know what happened in the beginning. But that's a big question, so let's just narrow it down to asking just a simple question. Where did Turtle get his shell? Darwin, when he traveled around and he went to the Galapagos Islands, he saw that there were lots of these giant turtles, and all of them had different, well, not all of them, but there were lots of different kinds of shapes of shell and stuff, and that was one of the things that got him thinking and questioning the biblical account. Because he said, if God created turtles, they should all be the same. Strange logic, but okay. And so now the fact that we get different turtles with different shells, maybe, you know, there was something else. So we want to know, where did the shell come from? So now let's see, well, what are our options? Here are the three options we are going to debate. So each of you is going to take one of these, and you're going to defend it. One is, it was great. In other words, there was no turtle, and then an intelligent being, God, said, let there be turtle, and he was there with his shell. Other one, it evolved. There was something sort of non-turtly, he didn't have a shell yet, and then he gave birth to, well, it depends if you're Lamarck or if you're Darwin. If you're Lamarck, then maybe he just, I don't know what he did, but his maybe he scratched and it became hard, and then his, yes?
Lamarck's theory is largely neglected now.
Yes, and there is some evidence for it. Okay.
There's, well, I've never found it. Because you can't change genetic structure during a lifetime, it can't be passed on.
Simplistically, yes, that's false. There is actually a little bit of evidence for it, but let's not get sidetracked. Okay, but anyway, according to Lamarck, he rubbed and then he got a little bit of a shell, and then somehow that got into his genes, and so his offspring also had a bit of a shell and so on. According to Darwin, just gave birth to somehow a young, which had a shell even though the father didn't. And then there's another option. And this is part of African American indigenous legend. And they say, turtle used to not have a shell, but they had hair. And the little turtles one day went for a picnic. They must have been South African turtles because they had a bright flax. And while they were doing that, one of the little turtlets got his hair on fire. And so he was running around and what is all this saying? Because now, what are the parents going to say? So they pushed him in the swimming pool. And his turning hair shrank and hardened to a shell. And that's where turtle got his shell. Some of you are going to defend that. So, let's look at these options. It evolved. Now, I want to see by a show of hands. Who believes that evolution occurs? Okay, so I'm giving you two options only. Maybe not fair, but anyway. Does evolution occur? You're going to put up your hand for yes or no? Okay, so who thinks yes, evolution occurs? No, evolution does not occur. And some hands don't go up. What does evolution mean? Evolution means change. Do animals change? Look at that picture and what's the answer?
Yes.
These all were bred from the same stock, a wild wolf. So they all have the same great-great-great-whatever grandfather. So do animals change? Yeah, of course. Let me look at that picture. You see, the right answer to, does evolution occur? Does change occur? Of course it occurs, but there are limits. That's the issue. There are limits. And it seems there's a bit of a logical problem that seems to say just because there's change, there are no limits. All right. So, the first important thing to understand is that there's a distinction between two types of evolution, and unfortunately, people tend to use one word for both of them. And that is microevolution, which is often called variation within a kind, and macroevolution. And this is, I don't want that one. This is a bit of a definition. You can turn to page 9, and if you're fast, you can write this down in that space, but just listen, you're going to do an activity just now on page 10. So what's the difference in micro? Micro means small. There's small changes. Macro, there's big changes. And in micro, it's just due to organizational changes. You know, for example, here, we had moths. We had a population of moths. Some of them were white and some of them were black. Afterwards, we still have moths, and we even have still white and black ones. But it's just a change in the ratio of their numbers. There's a very small change. That is a change in the frequency of the genes, perhaps. Whereas with macroevolution, we need an introduction of information. I'll get to this now. Here's a fish. He's got gills. Those must be get lost. These have got lungs. That must be gained. The losing of the information is not such a problem. The gaining of the information is a big problem. Here, information is not being gained. It's actually being lost. Here, information, DNA messages have to come from nowhere. A totally different process. And that gain of information causes a big, major change of structure. And that has never been observed. Whereas microevolution's often been observed. So in terms of a turtle getting a shell, Is that microevolution or macroevolution?
Macro.
No, it requires the introduction of information. You have something which has no information for shell, and it gets it. That's macroevolution.
I know, but there's no reason why that information couldn't be done.
All right, but then we're speaking about the step before that, before it even got into the dormant state. That was then. That was the macroevolution step. But by definition, you know, if you're going to introduce information, if that information was not in the blob of goo, so it had to be introduced at some stage. The point at which it was introduced, that would be the macroevolution event. Not a variation within the kind. Good. Now, let's get to another option. It was designed. Intelligent design. Now, in this book, we also try to encourage or develop skills of argumentation or debate. What do we mean by argumentation? I'm not meaning having a fight. I'm meaning being able to reason through to a conclusion. Being able to convince someone intellectually. And so let's use this as a vehicle to do that. You can see that in page 87 and 88, there are some notes about argument. Right, remember when I'm using the word argument, I'm not meaning fighting. Right, first of all, an argument must consist of premises, which can also be called backing, and a conclusion, also called a claim. So, I mean, we speak like this all the time. This is how we converse with one another and try to convince one another of various things. A preacher possibly preaches that way. So this is not foreign. For example, I might say, this camp is fun. If I just say that, this camp is fun, I'm making a claim, or I'm making a conclusion. But to my mind, the question comes up, why? Why do you say so? What makes it fun? In other words, my claim is limited, it's weak. If I just say this camp is fun, I need to back it. I need to support it. How do I do that? I give reasons why it's fun. Because we get thrown in the swimming pool every now and then, whatever. That's a backing. Okay, so let us practice identifying claims and backing on page 11. This is a statement here about intelligent design. Now, some people have been telling me, I've had quite different conflicting little things as I've gone around. Some people have said that I haven't yet gone in enough detail, or getting to the detail, okay? And some people have said maybe some people are lost. Let's try. But here is a little foretaste of some detail. We'll get to the detail later. But now, this is just an argument explaining an intelligent design person's viewpoint. And it says, if intelligent design is true, then we would expect to find no transitional fossils, the presence of information, and evidence of design. I know that this is maybe information overload at this stage, but let's deal with it little by little and we're going to get there. There would be no transitional fossils because evolution would not have happened to make intermediate forms, and information is a characteristic of intelligence, and so it is expected from an intelligent designer. Finally, it's reasonable for an intelligent designer to design things in a way that would suit them for their function. Right, now that's quite a lot of stuff. But what you need to do is you need to identify what are the claims. So you're going to circle three claims that are made over here. And then you're going to underline the backing that backs that claim and link them. Let's do the first one together. What is the first claim that's made here? If it's true, then carry on. It's not a complete claim just to say if it's true. If it's true, then there should be no fossils. There should be no fossils.
No transitional fossils. Right, so we'd expect no transitional fossils. So circle that. That is the first claim. In other words, if evolution is true, we should not find a turtle fossilized with part of a shell or a shell that is partway between the rib cage and inside and outside the rib cage. That's a transitional form. That's an intermediate form. That's a step from not having a shell to having one. If intelligent design is true, there should be none of those. We should find fossils of things with no shells. We should find fossils of turtles with shells. Not something. Right, so that's our claim. If I just make that claim, that's weak. I must say, why am I saying that? What is the backing for that particular claim? Anyone? That's right, because evolution, I don't really need it, because evolution would not have happened to make intermediate forms. So that is the backing that supports that claim. Okay, now let's go to the third option. It formed from burnt shrunk hair. Now, let's use that as a vehicle to teach some fallacies of argument, some wrong ways of argument. And here's a list of them, and I'm going to have to go through them very fast. There's a list you can read. Let's go into each one. Equivocation. When you argue by using a different word, and we were busy having this talk here, linguistics is a tool, it's a sneaky tool to make you win an argument unfairly. Because, you know, some people say the word evolution, means change, and so, of course, evolution occurred. My university textbook said evolution is a fact which can only be denied by abandoning reason. Now, they are using the word evolution in a way meaning change, small change. Yes, small change is a fact that can only be denied by abandoning reason. But we who read that think they are meaning monkey to man is a fact that can only be denied by abandoning reasoning. They're using equivocation, they're using a word in a different way to what it was intended. And you can have lots of debates like that and go around in circles, like, is man an animal? Problem with both the word man and animal, what are you actually really meaning? Then arguing in a circle. When you argue in a circle, then you are saying something where the backing will only be true if you assume that the claim is true. So, for example, you might say, it's possible for an organism which seems to be well designed to evolve without a designer. Look around you. All organisms in the world seem to be well designed. So they've all evolved. So you are assuming in your backing, this is your backing here, and in your backing you are assuming evolution occurred. And you're using your backing to support your claim, which is that evolution occurred. And that's circular. Next, arguing ad hominem. Yes.
Isn't that called circular reasoning?
You can call it that if you like. Yes. Now here, we don't worry about the logic of the argument. We just make a personal attack on the arguer, on our opponent. So when we're going to have our debate on Thursday, you must check out if your opponents use any of these fallacies. So like here, many people say, intelligent design can't be true because it's just stupid people who believe it. That is very weak. Next, appeal to authority. And that is where we don't undergo an intellectual argument, but we just appeal to someone who knows more. Like we might say, evolution's of course true because scientists say so. Creationists can also be guilty of this, if one can say guilty. We can say evolution can't be true because the Bible says it's not. Now, careful, I believe that. I do believe evolution's not true because the Bible tells us that's the primary thing, but I can't use that when I'm debating a scientist. Okay, so in a scientific context, then that is not strong argument. Of course, there is a place for it. And then asserting the consequence, where an effect which could possibly be a consequence of a cause is taken as proof, even though there could be other causes. This is the difference between proof, evidence and proof. So, for example, let's take the top example first to understand it. You know, you obviously, if you're going to bump into a car in front of you, your lights are going to be damaged. So, if I see your lights damaged, I can say, oh, that proves you must have bumped into a car in front of you. But although it's evidence that could suggest you might have, it's not proof that you did. Yeah. Because there are other ways you could have got that thing damaged. You know, someone could have come with a stone and broken it. And here we have another one in the context of origins. If an intelligent being designed organisms, one would expect organism structures to be well suited for their functions. Organism structures are well suited to their functions, so they must have been designed. Now, I do think that this is evidence that suggests that there was a designer, but it isn't actually proof that there was. So we must also be intellectually honest, because this, of course, is an intelligent designer's argument that I've just given, but it is actually, it has a weakness to it, because it's asserting the consequence. Then we can have false cause, and I couldn't actually think of an example in the origins section, but I remember myself, once I was doing a practical at Portchester University, and my friend, she poured some water down the drain, and just as she did so, the electricity went off. So she said, oh, I made the electricity go off by pouring the water down the drain. Because, you see, she did something, an action, and it was followed by an event. So, you know, cause is first, and then effect follows. But, you know, just because something comes before something else doesn't necessarily mean that that is the cause of that. So that's also a false argument. Now, I know that I've gone through that very fast, and I know that one needs time to assimilate all that, which is why you have the book, and you should go through page 87 and 88 and take a look at those things.